welcoming Johannes Werner.
Well, thank you, Tim, for the kind introduction. In a setting that's almost as beautiful as the Malecón in Havana. I also wanted to express a quick thank to the Alliance for Responsible Cuba Policy, who is also one of the sponsors here, along with Tucker Hall. I'm very honored to introduce Rafael Hernandez to you. I followed him from afar for many years, and that's partly because he's been a traveler between the worlds, and that's probably the best way to describe it. Until not too long ago, the United States and Cuba were almost separate worlds, and he has been a traveler between those two worlds. We almost crossed paths in 1988 when I was at the University of Texas. He was a researcher at that time at the University of Texas, which was highly unusual. In 1988, there were few Cubans to be found in the United States who were eager to return to the island. I ran across him often again ever since I started covering Cuba for Cuba Standard, and that's mostly because of Rafael's journalistic activities. He's done so many things, but I want to focus here on his journalistic activities. In the middle of the special period, in the middle of difficult years in Cuba, he started a magazine called Temas, Topics. Temas has been very helpful to me as a journalist covering Cuba. Covering Cuba is like a big puzzle. I love that Spanish word for puzzle, rompecabezas, headbreaker. I am always searching for pieces. There are so many gaps to cover about Cuba, and Temas has been very helpful in helping me understand where the gaps are and fill some of those gaps. The reason is, from very early on, Rafael and Temas have played an important role in bringing different opinions to the fore. There have always been discussions within Cuba, but that was not so much for public consumption. What Temas did is it brought out a spectrum of different opinions within Cuba into the public eye, and that's a very valuable service. Temas and Rafael Hernandez have also, I would argue, broadened the spectrum of opinions in Cuba over the years. They have brought in opinions that were not easily heard in Cuba. For instance, Cuban-American voices, Cuban-American academics who have been working in the United States for many years, got their forum at Temas magazine, and that was quite a step to do. Big admiration to Rafael, and great to have you here with us.
Thank you very much. I am honored by this invitation. The Poynter Institute is a very well-known institution in Cuba. My journalist friends, old and young, are aware of the importance of the work done here at the Institute. And this is not only because of the very old ties between Cuba and this part of the United States, Tampa. The meaning of Tampa and the resonance of Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota, for us, Cubans, always. It is also because from Cuba, particularly journalists have followed the trajectory of small papers that are not the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, like the St. Petersburg Times. A long time ago, I had the experience, the opportunity of being interviewed by a journalist of St. Petersburg, came to Havana, and she knew everything. She was very good. She was very well informed. And she knew how to position her questions. This is not the case of every journalist from Cuba, I have to say that. So for me, it is an object of admiration, the work journalists do in this part of the United States. Well, of course I don't know what is going to happen between Cuba and the United States under the Trump administration. You think that I have an answer for that. I'm sorry to say no, I don't know. I would like just to put a few things, including US-Cuba normalization in the context of changes in Cuba. Because yes, Cuba is changing, and Cuba is not changing in the last 2 years, and Cuba is not changing only in the last 10 years, and Cuba is not certainly changing just when since Fidel Castro's back, almost 4 months ago. Cuba has been changing in the last 25 years. This is a whole long period of change. I am not going to talk about the history, I am going to talk about the present, but I'd like to begin by making this fundamental point of my presentation. What I would like to do is to understand what is the role played by the US normalization, US-Cuban normalization factor in the context of this change. I don't have an answer for every problem. What I would like is to give you an overview of the context. The context is a fundamental view to understand anything about the present and also to think about what may be possible in the future. I would like to begin by saying this. There are two basic points I would like to make. One, Cuba is as complex as any society and as any polity in the world. Cuba is not black and white, is not government and dissidents, is not young and old, is not yes or no. Shades between yes and no are fundamental to if you want to learn what is happening. If you want to learn the core reality in Cuba. The complexity of this political and social Cuba may be portrayed by the political consensus. What used to be in the 1980s a rather homogeneous, relatively speaking, homogeneous political consensus in Cuba since the 90s to the present evolved, that was a much more heterogeneous consensus, which means that disagreement is also, is today part of the natural landscape. And the Cuban government, if you listen to the Cuban government, recognizes that that disagreement is dissent, is part of this natural landscape. The practical consequence of that, of the measure of that, is that something that was taken for political opposition in the 1980s, in 1988-89, today is part of the normal speech that you can listen to or read in many things that are published or debated in Cuba today. I would like also to mention that from a viewpoint, Cubans are very political people. That has nothing to do with a particular ideology. That has to do with a civic culture. The meaning of that is no matter where they are, if in Cuba, in Hialeah, or in Sweden, the Cubans will talk politics and will discuss politics. No matter if the subject is what is the best beer in the world, or how to grow tropical fishes. 15 minutes later, the Cuban, no matter where, will be talking politics. And I My interpretation is that this is part of the Cuban civil culture. And it is like that. It has been like that for many years. And of course, the last half a century contributed to reinforce that. My second point is that Cuba is an island, but as you know, because you have no way to not know that Cuba is right there. This is not China or New Delhi. This is St. Petersburg. This is not an island in the middle of the Pacific. This is an island surrounded by neighbors. So close, not only the United States, that it is impossible to not be able to listen to radio stations from other countries normally. Do you remember radio? Do you remember normal waves? Okay. My father used to get up in the morning and turn on the BBC in Spanish, and Radio Netherlands in Spanish, and Radio Caracol, and the Crystal Size Monitor, and many other radio stations that you can listen to just turning on the radio in the city of Havana. Then, today, Cuba is perceived as disconnected. I'm going to talk about that in one of my points. But I want to say, since my introduction, that if you believe that the Cubans are disconnected with the world and live in another planet, in a pre-internet history, perhaps you may not understand what is happening. And you may not understand what are the real Cubans thinking, and what are the factors of driving their behavior. Well, I would like to talk about what I call the transition matrix. But before getting to the matrix, I would like to begin just as an appetizer, and particularly because many of you are journalists. I would like to begin by 7 accepted ideas about Cuba that I find highly questionable. And those 7 accepted ideas about Cuba, the accepted idea is a term used by Gustave Flaubert, the famous French novelist, who wrote a dictionary of vérité reçue, receive truth. Accept the truth that you don't test, that you take for granted, and create a sort of common sense. Common sense is what you take for granted, that you don't try to test. So, I would like to begin by a list of accepted truths that are very common when you read international media, when you read European media, when you read American media about Cuba. And I find highly questionable all of them. 7, because I like 7. Maybe 77. Socialism in Cuba is Castro's Cuba. Nothing to do with 11 million people, with they think, what they have in their minds, what they want to do or not to do, what is their political values, what is their mentalities. Nothing to do with that. It's about one guy or 2 guys that are perceived as more or less the same person. Fidel Castro and Raul Castro, they are very different. One is tall, the other is short. Nothing to do in many ways, but nevertheless, this is the idea, the Castro. Well, the idea, the implication of this is that if this is Castro's Cuba, and Castro dies, that was a question I was asked when I came to the United States in the 1980s, that was a question that was never missing. What is going to happen when Fidel Castro dies? Now, that question is not anymore asked as the most popular question. The most popular question I am asked today is, tell me more about buying and selling houses in Cuba. Nevertheless, the idea that after Fidel Castro's death, Fidel Castro's death will be unleashing fundamental changes, some of those changes may be a popular revolt, that will overthrow the system or a movement towards a capitalist system as the capitalist system existing in Cuba 56 years ago, or the capitalist system that is around Cuba, in other countries in Cuba. But he's dead for 4 months now. Please come to Havana and walk down the streets and see for yourselves. And ask people how much this country has changed. That is an interesting question for a journalist or a normal person coming to Cuba. U.S. organization and both visited started changes. So Cuba was sleeping until Obama, President Obama started normalization. Obama came into the room and kissed the princess was awakened. And then the Pope came into the room too and opened the window. And the Sleeping Beauty awakened, looked through the windows and realized how much the world has changed since I fell asleep. That looks like a caricature, like a joke. I invite you to watch CNN when Obama visited Cuba. I invite you to read the New York Times when Obama visited Cuba. This is exactly what they were saying. The journalist who came to Cuba, I was interviewed by some of them. I was never been so interviewed in my life. Even by Univision Live, when the Air Force One was landing, I was there as a co-commentator. The main question, the first question was, what is going to happen in Cuba now that you have relations with the United States? Like the beginning of everything. And of course, normalization with the United States is an important factor. Raul Castro is the end of the line. There's no life after Raul Castro. Question mark. A mystery. Who is going to be the next president? The guy who is in the middle, does any of you know his name? Can identify him? Not Johannes, but Aileen.
Canel.
Díaz-Canel.
Miguel Díaz-Canel. He is the vice president. What will happen if Raul Castro dies tonight? Well, same thing that will happen if President Trump dies tonight. This is a hypothesis. If President Trump dies tonight, you know that the vice president will be, constitutionally speaking, the president. This is exactly what may happen in Cuba. So, since Raul Castro announced that he will not run for president next April, when we will have elections every five years elections. That will be next April election session in the General Assembly. A new General Assembly will be elected, and chances are, if you ask political commentators in Cuba, that the most likely candidate is this guy who is 30 years younger than Raul Castro, more than two generations younger than him. He is in the Politburo, which is the top political body of the Communist Party. He's been there for 14 years now. And he's every day on the Cuban press, he's every day on Cuban TV. So he's the most likely candidate to be elected by the National Assembly in next April. And I'd like to talk a little bit more about younger political generation in Cuba. It is not only him. Any dissent is prohibited and punished. Well, Johannes was mentioning that Revista Temas is opening up a space for debate. But one thing we do every month in the last 15 years is to organize a public debate last Thursday every month. If you happen to be in Cuba in the last Thursday of any month, in the last week of any month, but August, because Not August, because it would be suicidal to do something in August in Cuba, it's too hot. And in December, not in December, because everybody's drunk. I'm going to the church to celebrate Christmas now, and we are back to celebrating Christmas. The rest of the year, if you happen to be the last week of the month, you can come to the last Thursday debates. This last Thursday, which means 2 days from now, will be a debate about how much we need a new reform in the Cuban educational system. After that, we will have next month, in May, a panel on what is going to happen with the Trump administration in the process of normalization between Cuba and the United States. And in the month of June, we will have a panel on a constitutional reform. What is that? Do we need a constitutional reform? How should we have a constitutional reform? And this is not the first time we have a discussion on the constitutional reform that has been announced a few times. This was a debate about how the Cuban and the foreign media describe Cuba. Does he look like very official to you? The guy on the right, he looks like a heavy metal singer. He is a heavy metal singer. And he's saying very, very nasty things, very critical things about the Cuban media. Right there. There. Cubans are the most disconnected people in the world. This is a picture I took in a city called Trinidad, South Central Cuba, beautiful colonial city, where the vast majority of hotels are private hotels, bread and breakfast. 90% of the rooms in Trinidad are bread and breakfast, it's private. These people here, this family, there are the couple and the lady in the middle that you cannot see is the granny. What they are doing is using public Wi-Fi in a public park, in a public park in Trinidad. And they are speaking with their children, they are Skyping with their children who live in Hialeah. This is what they are doing. Okay? And if you take pictures of Cubans near the seawall, that Eric mentioned, the seawall, the Malecón, near all the seawall is a Wi-Fi public area. So when they are using their phones, they are talking with someone who lives abroad. So the phone is used that way. Mobile phones, emails, and internet connection, private and institutional, are expanding. If you ask me, between 0 and 10, what is Cuba in terms of internet use, internet connection, my answer is somewhere between 0 and 10. But it is moving. It is a moving target. Well, human rights is a favorite issue when we're talking about it. This is a picture of human rights in Latin America. If you read human rights reports, if you read the America's Watch, the Human Rights Watch, the OAS Watch, the OAS Human Rights Report, the United Nations Human Rights Commission reports about Latin America, you read about massive killings. You read about 43 students that disappear, that vanish, and the local police is involved. You read about people kidnapped, about people tortured, about threats of human life. What you read in those reports about Cuba, I am not talking about what the Cuban government is saying about human rights. When you read the Human Rights Watch about Cuba, 80% of what they say is about restriction to individual freedoms. What are the individual freedoms we are talking about? Freedom of expression, freedom to travel, and freedom of political organization. This is the fundamental human rights restrictions in Cuba, as listed by international organizations. Well, restrictions, there are restrictions, there have been restrictions in all these areas. Freedom of expression. Well, freedom of expression is my problem, because I am the editor of a journal. And expanding the subjects that are discussed publicly is something we try to do, not just this magazine, but many other people. So if you have visited Cuba 20 years ago, and you visit Cuba now, the public debate has expanded. The number of issues that are discussed publicly has expanded. The critical views about the government policies are debated publicly as a normal thing. Things that were issues that were prohibited in the 1980s or in the early 90s, today are part of common debates in Cuba. Issues that were only part of the political opposition agenda, today are part of the public agenda everywhere. So, have we reached the level of freedom of expression we need? Of course not. The struggle for freedom of expression is a permanent struggle, and new generations must redefine freedom of expression, not only in Cuba. Freedom to travel. Well, until January 16, 2013, a permission to travel was needed, a stamp on your passport if you wanted to travel. If you didn't have a permission to travel, you could not travel. Permission to travel for 15 days, for 30 days, for 3 months. If you stay out of Cuba for more than 11 months without having a permission to stay out of Cuba for more than 11 months, you could not return. Your right to return to your country was deprived. You could not return. Like many Cubans who came to this country, could not return. After January 2013, you don't need the permission to travel stamp on your passport. You need a visa. Many countries ask visas to the Cubans, with a few exceptions. Much more important from my viewpoint, they can leave and return. Leave and return. They may come to the United States, get a residence in the United States, and they don't lose their residence in Cuba, then the migration pattern that used to be one way now is becoming circular. So you have more and more Cubans who leave Cuba, and as long as the passport is updated, they can return and live again and return and live again. So that is a fundamental change in terms of freedom to travel. Freedom to create a political organization, that is intact. You cannot create a political organization. You are violating the law if you create a political organization. It is legal to criticize the law. It is normal to criticize the law. It is a violation of the law to create a political organization. So this is a specific about individual freedoms. And finally, this idea that was accepted by everybody, the Cuban American lobby is driving US Cuban policy. How this has happened? How we have had this normalization? Is the Cuban-American lobby, when I say the Cuban-American lobby, I suppose you know Senator Marco Rubio and Senator Ted Cruz. No? I'm talking about that. They are very opposed to everything happening between Cuba and the United States. Before December 17, 2014, the Cubans and the Americans that were increasingly visiting Cuba, they opposed that 100%. They oppose any kind of dialogue between the Cuban government and the American government about anything, including preventions to avoid oil spills in the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico because of Cuban companies or foreign companies drilling for Cuba, including that, including protection of the environment. And everything that happened in between Cuba and the United States in the last 2 years has been opposed by it. And it has happened. And I'm going to talk about that a little bit after the final slide. That was my appetizer. If you are hungry, let's get to the transition matrix. I call this a transition matrix because the mathematicians, and I don't pretend to be one, the mathematicians use matrix to describe a combination of variables that is not creating a linear equation. It is not one variable that independent and another dependent variable that creates a straight line. But these factors, these, in this case, nine variables, are interacting with each other. They are not depending on each other. They are separate variables that are interacting with each other and creating a complex. I told you this is a complex society and a complex polity, creating a new, different transition, dynamic, changing power. And I'm just going to list it because one of these variables is the US-Cuban normalization process. A new relationship between the state and the civil society. The relationship of the between the state and civil society in the 70s and 80s, that pattern changed fundamentally. 30% of the labor force in Cuba is not any longer depending on a labor employment, for example. And the way that public opinion look at the state and the state institutions, and the way those perceptions influence people's behaviors and people's mentalities, people's minds, is completely different. There's a new quality of that relationship. Number two, Cuba is a much more unequal society in terms of income. Differentiated strata. This is a more stratified society. Sociologists call the Gini coefficient a number that express inequality. In Cuba, in 1989, the Gini coefficient was 0.24. Today, the estimate is 0.40. But it is twice in terms of the Gini coefficient. It is more unequal and an increased poverty margin. So poverty has increased. So this is not only a more diverse society, but a more unequal society. A vibrant public sphere. The public debate is not just the official media. It's not just what you can read when you read drama or when you watch TV in Cuba at 8 p.m., almost at news time in Cuba. This is not the public sphere today in Cuba. This is not the information available. This is not the public debate in Cuba. There's a variety of actors, institutions, that may be public institutions, that may be religious institutions, that may be foreign actors that are participating in this public debate, because now, because of internet and because of the connection with internet, there's the line between inside and outside is blurred. It's not two separate worlds. An emerging political economy, which is basically economic reforms, policies that have created a new environment, a new rules, but not only the policies, but the implementation of the policies.
the formulation of the policies, the implementation of the policies, and the application of the policies. Those are three different levels. And the real application of the policies at the grassroots level, at the bottom level, that is a new dynamic, a new political economy emerging. I'm going to talk, to get back to that point in my last, one of my last comments. The transformation of the citizens' political culture. This is a new, much more controversial, much more diverse, much more heterogeneous, and much more challenging political culture. And there are positive and negative sides. New positive elements in that political culture, new negative elements in that political culture, too. The fading away of the historic leadership. Okay, let me give you a figure. In the 6th Congress of the Communist Party in 2011, the average age of the Politburo was 70 years old, or almost as old as I am. No, I am younger than that. not. In the 7th Congress, 5 years later, last year, the new Politburo is 63 years old. Still over 60 years old. If you look at the Central Committee of the Communist Party, the average age in the same period decreased from 59 to 54. And if you look at the 15 provinces we have, in the past, we had 6 provinces, and then 12 provinces. Now we have 15 provinces. In the 15 provinces we have today, the general secretaries of the Communist Party in each one of the 15 provinces, that are the political manager, the political bosses in each one of the 15 provinces, what is their average age? 46 years old. So they are not going to run Cuba. They are running already. That is not going to happen when Raúl Castro leaves power. Chief regional and international reorientation, Cuba was reoriented, had to reorient its international relations after the end of the Soviet bloc, and that reorientation is also part of a new way of insertion in the world. New relations with Europe, new relations with Latin America, also new relations with African countries, and now new relations with the United States. Normalization with the United States. Normalization with the United States, and I'm going to talk about that particularly now. Normalization with the United States was an interesting factor influencing the dynamic of the Cuban international relations. If you list the number of high-ranking officers from countries, from a variety of countries, that visited Cuba in 2015 and 2016, I took the pain to count them, prime ministers, prime presidents, president of parliaments, foreign ministers, minister of defense, from countries like Turkey, like France, like Japan, like Serbia, never been in Cuba. And you divide that between the number of weeks, we have 2 visitors of that ranking every week. And that happened after normalization. So normalization was an important factor influencing already active international relations. And finally, the definition of the socialist system as an idea. What is socialism? What is the socialist model? What is the socialist model that Cuba should adopt? It is clear that the model that was adopted in the 60s and that was constitutionally adopted in 1976 is not any longer defended by the vast majority of Cubans, including the Cuban leadership. In other words, the very idea of socialism is today debated critically and publicly. If you ask me, what is the definition of socialism? that is going to prevail 5 years from now? My answer is, I don't know. I don't know, because this is a real debate. Okay, let me get to the core of my presentation, normalization process and the US influence in this human transition matrix. I'm sorry for taking so long to explain the context, but I think that without the context, it's difficult to realize the real impact of normalization. And this is a choice of impacts. Number one, this is a picture I took. This is my copyright, okay? A photo I took on the other side of the fence. The American flag was raised in the US Embassy in Havana by the three Marines who took it down. 54 years, 6 months, and 2 weeks earlier. The same guys. And Secretary Gates. That was on the news. Perhaps you didn't see the other side of the fence. What was the crowd around the US Embassy doing? And perhaps you can see there the American flag, because there was no, this is the Maricopa. This is the ocean, it's right there, but the wind was not blowing. So the American flag is not visible, but it is at the top of the pole. What they are doing around me, I was taking the picture. They are clapping and shouting, Viva Cuba, Viva Cuba. What a strange thing. How can we understand that? They are happy because of the normalization, restoration of ties with the United States, but they are shouting Viva Cuba. It's a nationalist celebration. It's a nationalist celebration. And that is interesting in terms of expressing this human civic culture. Impact. What were the peace dividends? This is a list of the peace dividends. National security, common interest. This is an important issue because I don't think there's nothing more important in the US-Cuban agenda or in the last 50 years than national security. Cuba has been a national security issue for the United States. It has not been an economic issue. The economy is important, and may be important particularly in the current moment and in the future, but still Cuba is perceived in terms of national security. And I will give you the details on that. A renovated bilateral economic links with the United States. A new migration pattern that I mentioned already. A changed country image. The influence of the normalization process in the country image is a fascinating subject, particularly for journalists and analysts. Increasing information flow that has to do with increasing access to information on the internet, and a better environment for reforms, for the process of reform itself. Migration power. It has changed from the one way, as I said, to a circular migration. And now, the meaning of that is that now Cubans coming to the United States, getting their residence in the United States, and they don't lose their residence in Cuba if they don't have the health insurance for their teeth and for their eyes, they may get back to Cuba and have a dentistry appointment and a eye doctor appointment, and they have that problem solved. And this is not a theoretical example I am using, no? Because they have the best of two worlds. And they are here working, saving money, and sending money back. Because the main reason why they left is as part of the family strategy, which is the case in the last 20 years, 15 years, 10 years, and more recently. Particularly, now we have this important change in US migration policy towards Cuba, the end of the wet food, dry food policy. I suppose you know what is that. Okay, nevertheless, if a Cuban with a visa to come to the United States, a legal visa to come to the United States, seek asylum, the Cuban adjustment law is there to support that Cuban. So the chances to get a residence for a Cuban is still higher. Now, we may have, and we are certainly going to have, something that has not been alive, no new, this is a new creature, the illegal people. There's nothing like an illegal people in the United States, never in the past. Today, that may happen. Those who get to the United States in a boat or cross past the border and can stay in the United States legally. How much this end of the wet food, dry food policy is going to decrease, is going to reduce the migration flow is something we have to see. Number two, change country image of Cuba and the Cubans. If you read the New York Times in 2013, the image was Cuba is a tropical gulag. If you read the New York Times in 2015, Cuba is that part of the world, that city. Havana is that city you cannot miss. This is a tourist destination. Among the 12 cities in the world, you should not miss. So that was an interesting shift. And the Cuban leadership, the way the Cuban leadership is described, if you read the US media, when they describe Raúl Castro's speech in the Summit of the Americas in Panama last year, the words they use and the tone they use is very respectful. A statesmanship compared to other Latin American leaders. And his dialogue with President Obama was a model of understanding and dialogue after the American leader. I have a laboratory in Havana. I lecture almost every week to a group of 20, 25 Americans visiting Cuba. People to people. When I ask them, you look very much like them. The average age is rather higher. And so they remember the missile crisis. Of course, they remember the Olympics. They remember much more the missile crisis, of course. And they remember everything. And when I ask them, and this is fascinating, I ask them, why you wanted to come to Cuba? What was your impulse to come to Cuba right now? The answer, most of the answers is, I wanted to come when the Castros were alive. I wanted to see Cuba as it has been all these years. Because very soon, McDonald will come. And McDonald will change everything. And Cuba will become like another country. It is, from my viewpoint, it's like if they were visiting the Jurassic Park of socialism. They want to see the dinosaurs when they analyze. The Cuban tourism industry, the Cuban Ministry of Tourism, believe that tourists come to Cuba because they want to go to the beach. I have not found one American visitor that want to go to the beach. They want to see the Cuban society. They want to see the Cuba that has been all these years. And they see that Cuba, and they are very excited about what they see because they found that Cubans are there. The Cuban they have in their mind, Ricky Ricardo, didn't die. It's there, it's right there. Driving the cars, driving the all-American cars. You remember I Love Lucy? Okay. This is what they have in their minds, and the miracle is that they find that. This is Havana. Havana needs a lot of repairing and painting, but this is the Havana they have in their minds. And this is the car. So when they drive a Cadillac convertible pink, a pink Cadillac convertible, with a cigar in their hands and a shot of rum in their other hand, they are Humphrey Bogart and Robert McCall. See? Interesting. And of course, humans are all welcome, as welcoming as ever with the Americans. There's no bad feelings. I tell them, I tell anyone in the street, I am American. And look at their eyes, at the Cuban's eyes, and see if you find any animosity. Just do it. Do your own film research. Don't believe it. So, actually, there's a mixed feelings that I find around me in Cuba. On one side, welcome back the American flag. On the other side, they are afraid of the American tsunami. El tsunami americano. This is not what is happening. This is nothing. What may happen if the embargo is lifted? You know how many Americans visited Cuba last year? 280,000 Americans, not Cuban Americans, just Americans. Over a quarter of a million, more than ever. Only Canadians are more. 1,300,000. Second country that sent visitors to Cuba, the United States. I am not counting the Cuban Americans. The Cuban Americans are 400,000. For a prohibited country, that is not that bad. So the tsunami americano is going to happen because they are not tourists. They are visitors, according to the American. Then, I told you about this Santi Espiritus. You know, telecommunication companies like Verizon, Sprint, T-Mobile, AT&T have the license to do roaming in Cuba. There are increasing internet service in Cuba, not enough, certainly not enough, but the number of Cubans that have internet, private internet, institutional internet, access to email and cell phones. When the public Wi-Fi service was opened, next day, in those public parks. Next day, thousands of Cubans with this in their hands were there. Where did they get this? And, most importantly, how did they know how to use it? If this is a pre-internet culture. Well, as I said, we are always complaining to members of the Council of Cubans. That is not happening. But that is the debate. So let me finish with what happened between Cuba and the United States in the last weeks of the Obama administration. If you look carefully to these five agreements, the fundamental content of these agreements is national security, border control, anti-terrorism, Coast Guards, excuse the misspellings, Coast Guards and air and sea security, law enforcement, money laundering, human and money traffic, dry food, wet food, maritime boundaries in Eastern Gulf offshore, that is oil rights exploration. If you look at those four areas, my question is, which one of these four areas is the current administration going to roll back, going to dismantle? You may have a better analysis than I can. And finally, a new sistership between the Zapata swamps and the Everglades that I call a gator-to-gator diplomacy. Yeah, quite right. And all that, and the environment has been a fundamental area in which the two countries negotiated and made progress in the last 2 years. Finally, President Trump, this is a tweet written and published by President Trump 3 years after Fidel Castro's death. Imagine that. Some people in Cuba were really mourning about Fidel Castro's death. Those people were very, 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 very hurt by this tweet. Interestingly, the Cuban government didn't answer. The Cuban government didn't say a word. Granma, the official newspaper, which is not exactly very moderate, said nothing. They are waiting for actions. So this idea, the idea that unless there are new political changes, new democratic changes in Cuba as a precondition to continue normalization, the idea that preconditions, no matter what precondition, is going to facilitate changes in Cuba, or it is going to facilitate the continuity of the normalization process, may be a very peculiar idea. If the two governments started the normalization process was because the two governments left aside preconditions. The Cuban government stopped asking for having the embargo lifted before the embassies were open and before the dialogue started. The normalization process was started without having the embargo lifted. This is exactly the opposite of the China and Vietnam. The Vietnamese and the Chinese work out a new economic relationship, a normal trade and financial relationship, and then they have normal relations with the United States, I mean embassies. In the case of Cuba, the process was inverted. And the United States government left aside the question of what kind of political system they would like to have in Cuba. They didn't renounce to that goal. The Cuban side didn't renounce to the goal of having the embargo lifted, of course, but that was not the precondition. So, I can hardly believe that this is going to happen. Thank you very much. I don't know why we have the bad reputation of talking too long.
So this is where the conversation begins. This is supposed to be a conversation, obviously. And I'm going to take advantage of the bully pulpit here and ask the first question. How do you buy and sell homes? Never mind, you can read all about it in Cuba Standard. So I'm really interested in the spilling over of economic reform into the political realm in Cuba. One of the interesting issues, for instance, is the lineamientos, the guidelines of the Communist Party states that private property should remain medium. The idea is to avoid the concentration of wealth. This in turn has created insecurity among private sector entrepreneurs. How big is too big? How do you think this will be resolved?
We don't have a small and medium business in Europe, but we have a law that talks about self-employed. What is self-employed? It's a guy who works with his or her family. But the guy who owns three restaurants, three palabares, or owns 10 very well-restored American cars, is not exactly a self-employed guy. So under the category of self-employed, we already have medium and small business.
from my viewpoint, what I hear around me is more a discussion, not about how medium is medium or how big is big, but how and when Cuban professionals may start a business in which they could use their professional knowledge, their professional ability. Because now, if an engineer wants to start a private business, he has to choose between bread and breakfast, taxi, pizzas, sandwich, or palabras, and a few other things, like beauty parlor, barbershop, etc., etc. More than 200 jobs, but in most of those jobs don't require skills. So 26% of the labor force in Cuba are professionals. The majority of those professionals are women. The majority of doctors in Cuba are women. The majority of scientists are women. All those women professionals and men professionals that want to start a cooperative. A cooperative is the most socialist thing. Europe is full of cooperatives. You have cooperatives in this world. You can have a cooperative. And instead of a zero-sum game, public or collective or social or private, you may have a diversity of things, like an engineer or a nurse that may work in a hospital, public hospital, or work in a factory, public factory, and at the same time have a cooperative where the engineer may use his knowledge or her knowledge applied to something like computers, for instance, and the nurse may do something like a cooperative for elderly people, home services, elderly home people. More than 20% of Cubans are over 60 years old, and we don't have enough homes. And the Cuban government cannot provide enough homes. So the only way to guarantee that service is to create an alternative to that public service that existed for the child care center, but we don't need more child care centers, but we do need a much more homes that may support people over 60 years old. Then, to do that, it is necessary that the huge wealth of the Cuban, of Cuba, which is the people, the human capital, what is called the human capital. The human capital, the potential use of the human capital is huge, and it cannot be used if we continue thinking about the private sector or the cooperative sector like bread and breakfast and business.
I was in Havana 2 years ago, and then I was just there last month. And in that ensuing period of only 2 years, I noticed that there were construction cranes in Havana, where I didn't notice them as recently as 2 years ago. Is there kind of a construction boom, if you will, going on in Havana? And if so, where is the money coming from?
The most critical social problem in Cuba is housing. Healthcare is not a critical issue. Education is not a critical issue. Employment is not a critical issue. Salaries are too low. But employment is not a critical issue. Social security is taking care of people that are old and poor. But housing has been an accumulated critical issue, particularly in big cities like Havana and Santiago de Cuba. The last time a hurricane hit Santiago de Cuba, Sandy, that was very strong and went until New York, up to New York City, or New York State. That Sandy hit Santiago de Cuba and destroyed 15,000 houses and 45,000 houses. If a house is destroyed by a hurricane, it is not a good house. Because you know this is the Caribbean, and you know you are going to have hurricanes. So, is interesting is to look at what is happening all over Cuba when you have these new repairing houses intense way. That was not there 3 years ago or 4 years ago. 80% of the loans that Cuban's banks grant is not for private business. When you want to start a private business, you call your cousin in Miami and create a joint venture with them, which is a family business. The majority of the investments comes from remittances. Between $2 and $3 billion are estimated to enter the Cuban economy only for remittances. But the construction is exactly to what the Cuban banks are giving loans. You need a house, and you need to repair a house, you go to the bank and you ask for a loan. 80% of loans, according to the banking statistics in Cuba, are given to that. So, private citizens that may not have a crane, but are, if they are poor, they get subsidies. So they can repair their houses. So, a small construction brigade, a small and medium construction brigade, not big construction companies, but a small and medium construction brigade, I mean 4, 5, 6, 7 guys who are constructors, are now repairing houses in Cuba and building new houses. And if you visit any town in Cuba, any city in Cuba, you will see how much that is. If you come to Havana today and you visited 20 years ago, you may see the difference. If you have not that contrast, it is more difficult to see. But you are seeing that construction, new activity, new investments. Those who have cranes, they are building hotels. The number of rooms that in Havana available for tourists, private rooms and estate bedrooms, what do you think is increasing faster? Because the government investments are happening far away from Havana for new hotels. Keys. Cayo Largo, Cayo Santa Maria, Cayo Guillermo, Cayo Romano, keys. Far away. Those are the big investments. Hotels. Havana has hotels. But not enough for the number of just American visitors coming to Havana that don't want to go to the beach, that don't want to come to Cuba to go to swim in Cayo Largo. Of course, that is a good idea for Canadian families, but not for Americans. So, the only way to supply, to respond to that demand is to give more room, to give more chances to people who want to have a bed and breakfast. 5 years ago, the Ministry of Tourism was looking at the private bed and breakfast as competing with public hotels. Not anymore. So, what you can see in terms of big cranes is certainly those kinds of renovations. Mostly associated with hotels, not only. A lot of public works is done in Cuba, but the accumulated deterioration of the capital city is so huge that it takes a lot of energy and investment to do.
Cuba is reputed to have world-class medical system, high-quality, well-trained doctors. Is this not a resource that the country can capitalize on in the United States' relation to the rest of the world?
Do you know what is the first income, source of income in Cuba? It is not tourism. It is international cooperation. Doctors are exported not only to Venezuela or to Brazil, are exported to 68 countries. On a basis of an agreement
government-to-government agreements. They are in South Africa, they are in Angola, they are in Benin, they are in Algeria, they are in Pakistan, and they are in many countries in Latin America, including Honduras and Guatemala. So, I think that the Cuban Ministry of Health would love the idea of having an agreement with the Louisiana government to bring Cuban doctors to work in places where perhaps not all American doctors work Cuban. And this is a fundamental. My friend Johannes can describe you with figures. The question of drilling. Drilling and Australian wells, the oil found by the Australian companies that have every 2 months, there's a new announcement of something that indicates that there's oil there, but that never happens. Let's suppose that we are going to have oil exactly where the Australians found it. This is Varadero. So, tourism or oil? What is going to be the para? What is happening to oil economies in the world? Give me examples. Oh, with the exception of Norway, tell me what happened to oil economies. This is not exactly a model that is desirable from my viewpoint. Nevertheless, I think that the impact of that is important as long as the Cuban government finally reinforced the idea that we should have alternative energy. So the question of really, for sure, because there's no choice, every time we have a no choice situation, that is good. You see? Every time we have a crisis, every time we have the pressure that imposes an option and not postponing again and again, that may be good. In the long run, you look back at those options and see, okay, that happened because there was no choice. But that was good, positive. And now I think that the search for alternative energy sources, alternative energy like wind and solar, that has been there for many years. There's a lot of sun in Cuba. There's a lot of wind in Cuba. I think that today I see much, we are closer to really adopting that energy policy. But of course, this is not a free choice.
Buenas. Yo quería preguntarle sobre el
as far as I know, no. And what I know is that if you look at what may happen if tomorrow, if the timetable is that tomorrow morning they announce the unification of Cuban dollar currency, what is going to happen to the people with the lowest income is, so that is the real problem to me. The question of the real income. The majority of Cubans, the ordinary Cubans walking down the streets, care about the money they have in the pockets. No matter if in convertible pesos, or in Cuban pesos, or in Mexican pesos, or in rupees, or whatever. And what are the prices in the market? As long as the average income, the average salaries, are not enough to match with the average prices in the food market, for instance, as long as the 1 pound of pork meat. Pork meat is like the gold unit for Cuba, for the Cuban economy. What happens with the pork prices is defining what is happening in terms of the consumption. We can measure inflation using that. What is, as long as the pork meat in Havana, of course, is as high as 50 pesos now, which is $2 a pound, that is too much for the average people. So that is where the problem is for my people. So I don't know when is that going to happen. The double currency is a problem, but it is not the center of the problem.
I am not thinking of questions I want to be asked. I want to be asked questions, whatever questions, by people who are informed about what is happening, the real Cuba. There's no way to know that if you don't come. If you don't look at what is happening. There's no way to know what is happening in your risk to read internet, whatever. You have to come and see by yourself. I think there's nothing more important happening between Cuba and the United States than the 280,000 Americans visiting Cuba. There's nothing more important than that. Nothing more important, that is more important than the 500. That is more important than the 8 commercial flights coming, commercial airlines coming to Cuba. That is more important than Starwood running 3 hotels in Havana. Because it has to do with knowledge. Human contact. So, the most human contact, the better. The more human contact, the better. And more questions that are associated with the real concerns of the vast majority of Cubans. And also, based on the information. Do you know that the number one source of income in Cuba is international cooperation? Do you know that? You can check that if you look at the Cuban statistics. Sometimes journalists are not aware of public information. Public information that is there, and I may get to the main concerns and main issues that I do. Cuban social scientists, Cuban political scientists, Cuban anthropologists don't agree about many things. But the list of problems that I mentioned, the list of variables I mentioned, are like an overview of areas in which you may find different views. So you won't have one side or the other side. You may have more than two sides. So if you understand that there's always more than two sides, the government side and the political opposition side, but in the middle, there are many other views that are there that may be as important to understand the present situation and the future situation. If you perceive Cuba not as a bipolar country, bipolar is not, you need a psychiatrist if you are bipolar. This is not. And I think that the majority of Cubans have their own political perspective. And if you have two Cubans, you have three opinions. Which is healthy, I think. And everything that happens in Cuba is the main complaint, the typical complaint the Cubans blame on the government. No matter if they are sleeping in the street with a banana, this is because of the government. Okay. That is okay to me. These are demanding citizens. And demanding citizens is a very important actor
in any kind of social and political change. So, if you get connected with those demanding citizens, not one side, not just the other side, but the many sides, and Cuba is depicted in many times, it's depicted as Havana. Havana is 20% of Cuba. Havana is perceived not as Havana, but as Central Havana. And Central Havana is Cayo Hueso. So look at the documentaries about Cuba and the documentaries about Cayo Hueso. Cayo Hueso is real. Cayo Hueso is not invented. It's real. But this is not the country. The society is larger than that. Yes, sir.
Hi. Earlier you said that the concerns, 80% were related to the OAS, were concerns about, but a part of the situation, what was the 20% of the human stuff? Body and rights.
The 20% are people that say that they have been tortured. They have been, someone has been killed. People that are saying to reporters, or human rights reporters, about this and about that and about this and about that. If you read all these reports, the vast majority are about what I was saying. The vast majority that you can find. And even in the America's Watch, I think that to put anyone in prison for just speaking of their minds and criticizing the government is stupid and it's a mistake. And this is not just. This is not justice. So I think, so I don't approve that personally. But I think that if you look at what is perceived in the context of Latin America, you have to take into account what is the nature of these human rights violations they are described in those reports. That was the point I wanted to make.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Would you be able to describe the relationship between Cuba and Russia, and also comment on whether that relationship might be impacting U.S. policy for Cuba at the moment?
Well, I was thinking about that. I was thinking, trying to understand the title of this presentation, the Trump administration, if geopolitical perspectives could find a rational way to approach Cuba, particularly to avoid any other Cuban presence near Cuba of Russia or China. If you look in terms of geopolitics, and you leave aside for 1 second the South Florida politics, that I don't underestimate, but let's leave aside for 1 second, and you look at the global geopolitics, perhaps the 16 generals who sent a letter to President Trump saying that, hey, look at China and Russia. This is not a good idea. Because national security is a fundamental backbone in U.S.-Cuba relations in the last half a century. Cuba has been a national security concern for the United States. And decisions about Cuba, if you look at decisions about Cuba that change one way or another, for good or for bad, have been decisions that are responding to events that have to do with national security, not with business. Okay? So, besides that, the Cuban government felt betrayed by the Soviets. And for many years, relations were very cold. Nevertheless, you know how many Russians live in Cuba? I was talking about U.S.-Cuba relations in terms of people to people.
there are hundreds and hundreds and thousands of Russians who stay in Cuba, married with Cubans that went to study in Eastern Europe or the Soviet Union, and brought back wives. Mainly Cuban men who brought wives, not Cuban women who brought husbands. Which is interesting because now we have a new Cuban cult. They call themselves Russian Cubans, that call themselves Palavinas. Palavina is a Russian word for what? For cold and hot. Palavina. Like you were. They call themselves like that. Very interesting. And they are the ones who go to the Orthodox Church in Moldova. They are the ones who go there. More like a cultural association, like a cultural encounter space than religious. It is religious, but much more cultural. So, Cubans and Russians develop a very peculiar relationship for more than 50 years. I'm talking human relation, because the Russians are very different, but they share with us the idea of friendship and affection. Russians may be very friendly very soon. May start a friendship very soon. Not every Latin American is like that. The Russians are, like Cubans, instantly friends, particularly with a glass of vodka, more friendly. And that connection may give, if a Cuban goes now, and there are Cubans living in Russia, if you go to Russia and you say, "I am Cuban," "Ah, Cuba, wow," and they open their arms, no matter what is their age. They may be very young people, but they have Cuba in their mind, and Cuba and the Cubans in their mind. So I think this is an important ground to develop relations, good relations. Economic relations, cultural relations.
I have a political organizations question.
Mm-hmm.
Do you believe that if expression is protected and, as you call it, justice and necessary, that political expression is going to be able to be effective and not merely ventilation, unless accompanied by some form of mobilization by the political organizations or something like unto political organizations?
That is a good question. Because in countries where you have two political organizations that are competing for government, sometimes the outcome is not exactly a democratic one.
Good answer to me.
No, that is not my final answer. If you come to Cuba, I will introduce you to two members of the Communist Party that are more different than any Republican and any Democrat you can find. Come and I'll show you. And they are so different in the way they think about everything. So, this is the one party we have. Should we have more than one party in the future? Perhaps. For me, this is an open question. As long as we are talking about democratic parties. Because if you add two undemocratic parties or three undemocratic parties, you may not have necessarily a democratic political system, a democratic party system. So democracy, the question of democracy, the question of citizens' democracy, the question of how much the Cuban institutions, the Cuban political institutions, must respond to the desires and interests of their ordinary citizens, no matter what is their social origin, no matter what is their color, no matter what is their region, no matter what is their gender or their social or their sexual orientation. That is where I see the majority of discussions about democracy in Cuba today.
Thank you.
We have space for one more question.
After the next question, I will I will need an extra way.
Let's make it two. I see two hands. So let's start with the gentleman in the back.
A controversial issue here in the States, politically, socially, and perhaps national security-wise, is Guantanamo prison. How does the government respond to that, and as well as the people?
The people from Havana or the people from Guantanamo?
I'll let you decide, or both.
The people from Guantanamo are very unhappy when they click internet and they Google Guantanamo, and the first 15 screens are about the base, and the prison, and the base, and the naval base, and the history of the base, because they believe Guantanamo is a real world, is a real place with real people. They have their own cultural identity. They have their own dances. They have their own music. They have their own literature. They have their own food, and they are very proud of that, and nobody knows about that in the world. The bay is the second largest bay in Cuba. Mariel, which is right across the Gulf of Mexico, right there in front of Tampa, Mariel fits 16 times within Guantanamo Bay. The most important natural resource they have. They cannot use it, because who in the world would like to invest in a bay where the entrance of the bay is on the is a military base, is a US military base? Who is going to invest there? I visited Guantanamo a few times, and last year I went there. I was with my wife, who is with me here today. And we were looking to the water, and the water is transparent. No ships. It's a pure water, pure sea water. Too pure. No. And Guantanamo is the least developed province in Cuba. So, for the Guantanamo people, the base is problem. It's a very serious problem. The most rural, the less developed, less urban. In Cuba, 76% of all Cubans live in urban areas. 24% live in rural areas. In Guantanamo, it's the opposite. And poverty and salinization of the soil and all that is part of the environmental problems they have. And they cannot use that resource. The Cuban government agenda about that is that Guantanamo is part of the US-Cuba bilateral agenda. The Cuban side will never announce to bring back to Cuban sovereignty that piece of territory where the American military are since 1898, since the Hispanic American War, longer than any other military. So, if the Panama Canal was negotiated, if Hong Kong was negotiated, if Macau was negotiated, why not? One panel. Negotiated is negotiated. At least to have a term. A term that may negotiate a new agreement by which both sides agree about this is going to be a 25 years agreement. That would be great. And in the meantime, we could start. This is my crazy idea. No, this is not a Cuban government position. This is my crazy idea. In the meantime, they could start a binational authority that may develop in that area called today the Guantanamo Naval Base, an institution, a complex to develop environmental protection, preventing hurricanes, healthcare, schools for people in the Caribbean that may come, protecting the birds that come from the United States to Cuba freely
without visas, freedom to travel, and back, sea currents, the Gulf Stream is bringing here everything that happens between in the Florida Straits and everything that is happening on the Cuban northern coast. So, an environment is a fundamental common ground between Cuba and the United States. And Guantanamo is exactly, if you look at the map, is exactly in a vantage point about the Caribbean sea lanes. The same way Havana is on Marielis on the northern coast. That tremendous importance, geopolitical importance, Guantanamo had since 1898, today might become a geoeconomic asset that both countries could use in a bilateral agreement. Both countries would be benefited mutually. Thank you very much. If you go to Temas.cu, you will find the last issue, the digital edition, the printed edition will be available tomorrow in Cuban bookstores. You can read the entire issue. This issue is what is going to be the public sector. What should be the public sector? And the next issue, the digital edition available in our website, is on inequality and poverty. Focus on field research on inequality and poverty, not only in Cuba, but in other Latin American countries and in other countries in the world. So you are invited to read. We have a website. Besides the digital edition, we have also a sort of blog. We call it a blog. It is when you click Temas Kulku, you will find Catalejo. Catalejo means spyglass in Spanish. In Catalejo, we don't publish what we publish in Temas. In Catalejo, we publish shorter articles, more readable articles, because it is a boring academic magazine. If you want to read something interesting and readable, and sometimes in English. So our idea is to more and more, maybe if we could find much more contribution on this site, to publish in English and in Spanish the same contributions. So a lot of what are the controversial topics and the debated questions in Cuba, national and international, you can find it there, not only written by Cuban authors, but also by authors from different countries, including the United States. You are invited to send us your contribution. Thank you.